and I was talking to the board when I called it.
Thank you. The last detailed presentation that I made to the committee, I think, was in October, and I'm sure the committee is familiar with the outline that I provided then in terms of work that lay ahead in establishing the Department of Higher Education and Training, and this presentation will build on that. I think everybody's aware of the national project in terms of the lack of organization of the state, and what that means is that we have to establish a new Department of Higher Education and Training, and that Department of Higher Education and Training has to be established on the basis of resources, including personnel, which must be taken from the Department of Education and the Department of Labor. And the complexities of that task, I'm sure, will be immediately apparent. When the President made the proclamation to transfer the legislation that was previously in the Department of Education and previously in the Department of Labor to the new Department of Higher Education and Training, there were a range of consequences, and I'll quickly run through them. Basically, the Department of Education will close at the end of March 2010, other than mopping up operations in terms of its ongoing liabilities and reports to Parliament in terms of financial accountability for the 2019 financial year. But there's two new departments being established, Basic Education and the Department of Higher Education and Training. There's a large number of functions moving from the Department of Labor to the Department of Higher Education and Training. And with that shift of functions, there's a whole range of responsibilities. Organizational scoping and design requires that one looks at the legal functions, what aspects of the law are allocated to new departments, what functions in terms of organizational structure are allocated to perform that legislation, and that's what we mean by organizational scoping. That then requires that once you have a sense of the scope of the new organization, you then design an organizational structure to fulfill that scope. What follows from that is that once you have a sense of what the functions are of the new department, you then have to identify what posts have been created by the DPSA in order to fulfill that function. Once the posts have been identified, you can then start the labor relations processes of moving staff, funding, and assets in terms of the move, as well as then proceed with all of the logistical relationships, switchboards, IT, server, buildings, etc. And all of this has to be done in consultation with union and staff, with some change management processes. At the same time, you have to carry on with your current educational functions and do all of this within the existing budget, with no additional budget being allocated to the two departments which have the budget, which is the Department of Education and the Department of Labor, because the Department of Higher Education and Training doesn't have any budget. This is a repetition of a slide that I used last time, which is that once we've concluded all of those processes, and we are very close to concluding, we had hoped to conclude on Monday, but there's still unresolved matters and we haven't concluded. So after consultation with labor and departmental chambers, but particularly in the National Bargaining Council, after approval by the three ministers, a determination by the Minister for Public Service will be made on the transfer of functions and concomitant staff. And the good news is, once the determination is made by the Minister of Public Service and Administration, the Higher Education and Training Department will be more than one person. It's not quite correct to say it's only one person. I did succeed in having DDG Feroz Patel seconded to the department several weeks ago, and he's been helping enormously. And we have just made a submission to the minister to have an acting DDG responsible for skills development appointed on a 4-month basis, whilst we then advertise, and I'm hoping that appointment will be in place, the person's already assisting. If I can just talk about a progress report in terms of the Department of Education. We've agreed in terms of the legislation determining a functional split. There are some very complicated components in terms of the legislation, if I can just talk about the one, and that is the question of exams. Previously, the further education and training band of the National Qualification Framework was conceptualized as one unit, and the FET branch of the higher of the Department of Education ran both the further education band of schools as well as further education colleges. With the new department, there's a split in a conceptualization of what is school and what is post-school, and that has implications for the examination function. The assignment of the legislation gives responsibility for most of the Umalusi work to the Department of Higher Education and Training. So how we manage the functional split of exams to ensure continuity immediately as well as a basis towards the future is quite critical. We do have, I think, as from Monday, an agreement to the quantum of the split across functions that is ready for ministerial approval. Now, if I can explain what I mean by the quantum of the split, there are functions that move more or less intact, and I'll come to the detail of this later. But, for example, the branch of higher education goes entirely to higher education and training. But there are split functions. Finance has to be split into two. Half of it, more or less, has to go to higher education and half has to go to basic education. Communications has to be split, exams has to be split, and you'll be interested to see that teacher education has to be split. But the question is, it a 50-50 split? And it's not a 50-50 split. Every function, every box has to be negotiated in terms of how much work, how much of it goes to basic ed and how much of it goes to higher ed. So we have a range of splits from the intake functions where it's 0-100, some functions it's 25-75, some it's 50-50, some it's 64-40, some it's 63-33, whatever it might be. But that is now agreed and it is ready for the ministers to approve. Once we've got the split function, we then take the organigram of the DD, of the DOE and we sign it off in a modified way as the organigram for the Department of Higher Education and Training. Now, the interim organogram is basically a duplication of the DOE organogram for the purposes of the education staff. And the reason that it's just a simple duplication is because a person is changing their place of employment from one place to another, and you can't change their functions without other processes intervening. So if a person has been at a particular level managing communication, they have to move into the same job in the new department. Once they're in the new department, then we can restructure. So the new organizational structure will be developed and approved, and that's the next step. But you'll see when I talk about the budget is that the difficulties of doing all of this whilst the train is on the move is complicated. We still have to make decisions about which staff have to be moved. I've made proposals on the basic set of principles to the DG of the Department of Education and the DG, acting DG of the Department of Basic Education at the level of DDGs and chief directors. And once those proposals have been agreed, we'll then be able to work at the level of directors and make agreements after consultation with individuals about which individuals at director, chief director, DDG level will be moving into which departments, and then obviously that has implications for the boxes in the organogram for which those persons are responsible. But there's no, for some functions like finance, HR, and logistics, then there'll be further splitting within directorates. Only once the organogram is approved will we be able to recruit staff. So we will need to advertise, for example, for a DDG for colleges and for skills. I think those at the moment will be the key ones. But there's a whole range of other matters that need to be managed. And you'll see in the documents that were distributed an untitled project template for all of the work that needs to be done to create the new department. And members may want to ask detailed questions, but a lot of this is behind time because the lead department has to be the Department of Education and we're dependent on them. So we're working on the budget for 2010-11, and I'll cover that in detail. The question of accommodation, it's likely that we're going to stay in Salt Lake. There's a range of logistical implications of that. What percentage of the building we'll be using, the move of staff from the Department of Labor, making sure we've got a server, and that links to logistics and IT. But I'll give you a bit more detail. Now, just to give you a sense of the functions that are identified for transfer, We're taking the whole of the higher education branch. We're taking the chief directorate for FET colleges, the whole of the directorate for ABET, the National Human Resource Development Strategy Support Unit directorate has been taken intact. But systems planning and monitoring is duplicated across the departments of basic education and higher education, as well as auxiliary services office of the DG. Currently, that completely serves the Department of Education, and higher education has no auxiliary services, no parliamentary officer, no communications, all of the things that would normally assist. FET examinations is going to have to be split, as I explained. Social cohesion, we're going to duplicate across the two departments. Teacher education is being replicated in the organogram as a duplication, but it's in fact will be a split, and it's quite an interesting split. Corporate services, all of them have to be duplicated. In terms of the numbers of staff on the basis of the currently in group splits, if approved by the ministers and by the DPSA, that gives you a sense of the split of staff against across DBE and higher education and training. In terms of existing staff, there's no vacancies, all vacancies have been frozen, which means that when we get the staff, we won't be able to, it would be very difficult for us to get new staff in because we only have budget for the currently employed staff. So from education, the staff complement for higher education will be 504. But for some of the split functions, for example, if I go back to corporate site services and finance in particular and certainly exams, there will be for a period which is as yet undefined, those units continuing to function as a whole because you can't split without affecting functionality, and it's particularly the case for finances. In terms of the other streams other than staffing, most of the legal amendments have been taken forward in terms of the proclamation. Well, all of them have been as complete. We still have to finalize the MOU between basic education and higher education around the agency service for exams and the corporate services function. We are making sure that we're taking through our authority for the Ministry of Basic Education to sign the order for the new building, and then they will pay the cost of Salt Lake. We're working on which tenders have to be signed off. So, for example, there's tenders such as the travel agency that will have to have some sort of arrangement for continuity from DOE to DBE and higher education. Lots of legislation cleanup in terms of an assumption in previous legislation that there was a Department of Education, whereas now there's a Department of Higher Education and Training and a Department of Basic Education. The next one is a bit curious. I have explained it before, but basically what we have is a Department of Education with DG and a minister. And then we have two departments of higher education and training and basic education with no budget, no staff, but the minister and now DG. So DPSA has to make a determination as to who's the responsible executive authority for the Department of Education and for its closure. We're working on draft memorandum of understanding between higher education and training and the Department of Labor, between higher education and training and provincial education departments, which I'll talk about just now, as well as between the Department of Education, of Basic Education and Higher Education and Training. My view is that the change management and communications have been very poor. We've been dependent on the DOE for that, but the DOE has published transition bulletins. In terms of consultation with staff, we started consultations with the organized labor in the Department of Education on the 7th of October. The Department of Labor will now come to that separately. But with the Department of Education, we started consultations on the 7th of October. With the Department of Education, their board management consultation started on the 16th of October. Again, both of those are very late, but it's led by the DOE. We are not necessarily even invited to those meetings, so it's a Department of Education function. Union membership were briefed on the 15th of October, and the Departmental Chamber established a task team of members to deal with the day-to-day matters of the reorganization. I attended meetings during October that were meetings of all the entire membership were invited of Nahabu Shatu and PSA, and explained the the process, and there was a meeting with staff of the senior development staff on the 30th of October. So where we are with the Department of Labour, if I can move into the process report into Department of Labour, we have the assignment of legislation which determines the functional split, but there is very little agreement with the Department of Labour on several matters. Firstly, in terms of split functions like finance and HR, we don't yet have an agreed basis for which we can make that split. There's different figures that are proposed, such as 1% of their corporate function should come to us, and we say that sounds interesting, but we'd like to know the basis on which 1% is calculated. And you'll understand that this is a critical matter because the difference between 1% and 1 or 2% may impact on functionality. There's also no agreement about the regional staff. The regional staff in the Department of Labour's regional offices currently will fill for part of their time, possibly 50%. It would have to be quantified. Functions that have moved to the Department of Education in terms of their responsibilities, and we have to reach an agreement with Labour. There are several things that are unclear. First of all, the organizational scoping is unresolved, finalizing of staff audits. We haven't received any information from the Department of Labour, so we haven't been able to complete organizational structures, although the draft organogram that goes to the Minister this week does have what we understand to be the organizational structures. The major issue which we're getting advice on from the state law attorney, and you'll see my sentence is incomplete, is who's the accounting officer for Vote 15 in 2009 and 10. Our understanding is that the accounting officer is the person who is designated in the vote, which means that despite the function having shifted to the Department of Higher Education and Training as from the 1st of November, the DG of Labour remains the accounting officer. The DG of Labour is unhappy with that position, and so the Department of Labour is looking for legal advice from the state attorney. The problem with the Department of Higher Education and Training being the accounting officer, or the DG, is that the DG of Higher Education and Training has no financial staff, and neither does she have a CFO. She's one person on her own, so it's not possible for her to be the accounting officer, and the resolution that may emerge is that the Department of Education's DG, who has no functional responsibilities for skills, may have to be the accounting officer. The only thing that we've done to protect ourselves is to send a letter of expectation to the DG Labour saying we expect you to do this, this and this, so that if there are questions from the Auditor General or from the committee next year, we're going to be able to say, well, we made it clear to Labour that this is what would happen. What's important and why it's significant that Hubert Mashabani is here today is that because NSF is not part of Vote 13 in the same way, well, it is, but it's got its own CFO and accounting officer, that acronym is, let me see what I was thinking. The national, the accountability for the NSF is going to be with the DHET, with us. And so the NSF is transferred to us, and I'm in consultation, negotiation with DOE to request that Mr. Tim Strudel is appointed temporarily as the CFO for DHET so that he can take accountability under the direction of the DG for the NSF. If that's not approved by DG Hindle, then I've said to DG Hindle that he'll have to be the accounting officer for the NSF, which I'm sure he will not want. So in terms of what we know so far, and all of this is unconfirmed, the functions and staff identified from transfer from Labour to DOTT, number 370 of people below senior management service and 10 people at senior management service. The corporate staff, we don't know if it's going to be 1% or 2%, but when the 370 people come, the assumption is that there's 10 people that support them in terms of corporate services such as procurement, management of leave, all of that. So, in terms of the transfer of the college function, I just want to refer you to the medium-term budget policy statement after careful work with Labour. This is what was agreed with Treasury, and we're now in the process of working with provinces to make it implementable. Fundamentally, the problem with... let me go back and then come back. Let me start actually with the legislative work. The function of FET colleges and the FET College Act was assigned to the Department of Higher Education and Training. If you look at the FET Act, it talks throughout the document of provinces and their role, and it talks consistently of the Department of Education and its role. And what we need to do is to, in order to align the colleges with the national post school education and training system, we have to move the colleges to the National Department of Higher Education and Training. That will require a constitutional amendment, depending on how one interprets the constitution. So a cabinet member has been submitted, hopefully to be adopted before the end of this year, to request permission to proceed with a constitutional amendment in order to make the post-school function of colleges responsibility of higher education and training. Once we have a constitutional amendment, then we can change the Act. But in the interim, we're in a very difficult situation where colleges are legally and constitutionally with provinces, but the Act is assigned to us. So what that means is that for the provincial equitable share, we've asked for that to be ring-fenced and turned into a conditional grant. Treasury agreed, and the medium-term budget policy statement said two things, which I've just cut and pasted to remind you. So the funding of further education and training colleges is shifting to national government. Government will continue to provide resources. It can't shift to national government until the constitution and the law allows that. So it's still with provinces, which means it's in the provincial equity state. So we will continue to provide resources for quality improvements, but we need closer alignment of funding arrangements under the skills development levy so that we can make use of that money. What Treasury is saying is that they're not going to be providing extra funds from the fiscus for FET colleges. They're wanting us to establish closer working relationships between the CETAs and the colleges, which we're working on quite hard. The quote from page 60 is the more important one. The funding of FET colleges is shifting from provinces to national government, but not in the next year's budget. The equitable share baseline is adjusted by $3.4 billion. So the equitable share to provinces is being adjusted by $3.4 billion to reflect the new shift, which will come as a conditional grant through which funds will flow to the FET colleges administered by provinces, and those will be covered in a grant agreement for the conditional grant. So the administrative work that remains for next year is once we have a change in the legislation, we then have to have the same difficult negotiations that I've described in terms of education and labour with provinces to say you have this number of staff in your corporate supporting colleges and you now have to give us that resource. If we don't have those discussions, it means we take on a function without the necessary support. So once the legal work is done, we then set up a functional step with provinces to get the support from provinces for officials who will help us manage the colleges. And the conditional grant is the instrument to serve leadership that's being finalized in consultation with provinces and will be signed off between the DG Higher Education and Training and the provincial secretary generals. I'm trying to go as quickly as possible because I know you've got a full program, but if I can move to towards the 2010-11 budget. The impact of agreeing on the functional split with education is that it also has implications for the budget. So if the functional split ends up being 58%, 42%, or whatever it might be, 57%, 43%, whatever is finally negotiated, that will determine the budget for next year. So we're waiting for that. We're expecting to receive the indicative budget allocation from Treasury on the 20th of November. So whatever amount that is will then be subdivided on the basis of the functional split with education. That's for education. Once we have the basis of the functional split, then we'll be able to start linking our strategic plans with the money that's available. So we've begun the strategic planning process. I would suggest to the committee that we would really greatly value having engagement with the committee very early on in 2010 about the strategic planning so that we can have the wisdom of your advice on goals and strategies way before the budget process starts. One of the things that's guiding us in terms of our development of the strategic plans is we really want to seek maximum alignment with the work that's coming from the presidency in terms of policy monitoring and evaluation. We think that strategic plans should align with that framework because otherwise you have multiple compliance structures. And it also should align with the cluster program of action. So ministers are meeting on Friday together with DGs in the cluster to start looking at what they might take to the January Lekgotla in terms of a program of action. We want our strategic planning to very much inform the position of the minister in terms of the January Luchotla, so that the strategic plans that inform the budget process with the portfolio committee are similar to the strategic planning that's underlying the articulation with other departments in government and the program of action, and maximally informed by the monitoring and evaluation. Now this I can probably do quite quickly. I'm not sure, Chairperson, how much time you have. But we have already had to submit our program structure to Treasury. For next year will be the first year that there's a higher education and training vote, and we have to develop a structure for that budget so that when you consider the budget for next year, these will be the kind of line items that you'll need to consider. So we've structured 5 separate programs. Whether or not that in the end completely aligns with the organogram is clearly a challenge. Ideally, we believe that the program structure should be in alignment with the organizational structure, but until we've got the script, we can't be certain about what kind of organizational structure we can have. So the program one, as was the case in all of the other votes, is administration. Program two is a very important program because it combines our responsibility for human resource development, the HRDSA strategies, which we increasingly are looking very carefully at how we can articulate with the National Skill Development Strategy, together with planning and monitoring coordination across the post-school system as a whole. Program three will be more familiar because it's the university education. You'll note that we're calling it university education rather than higher education, and that's because we think that some of the, and I'm looking at my friend from SALCO, some of the tyranny of the bands we want to liberate ourselves from, so that the whole system shouldn't be structured on the basis of the bands of the NQF, but that university education isn't complete higher education system. That, for example, the colleges may very well be offering components of the higher education qualifications framework. Program 4 previously might have been called FET colleges. We're trying to move towards rethinking their focus into vocational and continuing education and training, and Program 5, skills development. So many of these will be familiar. Program 1, the sub-programs would be, as is the case with other votes, the Minister of Management, Corporate Services and Property Management. In terms of human resource development, the sub-programs would be the HRD strategy. That's the secretariat for the HRD council, which will be led by the deputy president, which he is currently having we have a cabinet memo before cabinet to consider the establishment of that council, and then the council will be established in the first 3 or 4 months of next year, if not earlier. We also are going to have the function of planning information and monitoring coordination across the higher education and training system as a whole, so that we don't have silos of the different subsystems that aren't coordinated across. And the more that we talk and the more that we spend time together, the more that we can see that there's amazing synergies across these subsystems. International relations, we decided to place for purposes of the budget in Program 2. And that signals to you that we think that in terms of organizational structure will belong there, as is the case with legal and legislative services, and both of those are located there because of their broad policy implications across the other subsystems. In terms of university education, it's more or less what we had before. It's university academic planning and management, university financial planning and information systems, university policy and development, and the subsidies. For what were the colleges, which will be program for vocational and continuing education and training, there's some 4 sub-programs, planning and institutional support programs and qualifications, social inclusion in the higher education and training, and teacher education. I think that the pace of developing, for example, the budget template to make Treasury meet its deadlines being disjunct with our processes, because social inclusion and higher education and training actually belongs in Program 2, and in our organizational structure we'll put it there. So this is going to create a bit of a hiccup next year in terms of financial reporting, because it's going to be a different DG, but it's manageable. Skills development, the sub-programs are CETA coordination, National Skills Development Services, and Quality Development and Promotion. That replicates what we currently have. And then the transfers, which are distributed across the programs, is the major transfers to CETAs, We'll continue with the transfers to India, Brazil, South African Trilateral Commission, the transfers to NSFES, to THE, National Institutes of Higher Education, to SAHPWA, and the National Skill Funds. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you, Gigi, for the presentation. Just to check, I noted that you circulated other documents and supporting documents to the presentation. Okay. Colleagues, that's your presentation. Shall I note him for comments, questions? Okay, I'll note starting with Dr. Honorable Member James, and then Honorable Member Buinamo, Honorable Member Muswana. Okay, let me take those three hands and then later we'll come back.
Thank you very much. I wanted to ask the Director General whether there is a policy documenting preparation, either a white paper or green paper or a discussion document, but a policy framework document that would be submitted to Cabinet for approval or presented somewhere for discussion that in fact identifies the major ideas that would be driving this whole process. So that was the one question. Then I had a very specific concern about the transfer functions in the FET sector to regarding colleges from provinces to the central government, and what precisely the thinking is in terms of when that happens, which functions are being transferred. That is, what is the architecture in terms of policy support for the FET sector, and does she think that the projected dates for when that would happen at the end of March next year, beginning of April, are realistic ones?
Thank you, Honorable William.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to find out from the Director General as to whether, given the modest budget that you have, are you going to be able to meet all your needs in terms of creating a new department? And how long is it going to take to establish and settle the department, including studying, seeing that there are no vacancies currently? And why are vacancies frozen? Is this not going to delay progress, as the department cannot run effectively with a scanty staff? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Vinam. Honorable Mishwan.
Thank you. I have three very short questions, third person of the session. The first one is on duplication. As the DG was reporting, she reported some duplication in some instances. I'm checking if this duplication has to do with the system itself or with the human resources. Such that even the human resource manning those offices will be duplicated. And the second one is on instances where there are non-agreements. I've noted a few of those. Such that, are you prepared to move with these non-agreements, or you believe somewhere, somehow, you have to agree? Because once it's put in a report that we don't have no agreements, it's like it's not possible to have agreements, and what happens? And finally, it was said that the individuals will be consulted, those will be moved. But there are no time frames as to when that's going to be done. So that if we know that, okay, they're going to be informed within these maybe periods, so that the next step will be for us to know the exact time for them to be transferred. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Honorable Mushan. This is just two things from my side. One is around the issue of time frames. I'm just looking at your project plan. There are things that have not met. What is the plan in trying to keep up, and any major consequences of for the department in terms of those? That's the first one. Secondly, noting that there's been staff meetings that you've not been part of, in building the relationship with the staff that you're likely to lead as a DG, how are you dealing with that? And because if that relationship is not established, it's likely to cause problems. Just those two ones from my side.
There's some overarching principles that I need to just explain that underpin all of the questions, and then I'll come to them individually. If we look at the timeframes, I could type quickly onto the screen, but I'll just talk. Legally, the minister is responsible for all of the legislation now. So there is, as you've indicated, a handout which indicates all of the legislation. The minister has no budget for any of this legislation, and the budget is with the DOE and the Department of Labour. That's it. The time frame is set by our budget processes. From the 1st of April, there will no longer be a budget for the Department of Education. The budget for the Department of Labour will no longer include any skills function, and you now have the budget structure for the budget of higher education and training, which you will then engage with us on. So in terms of budget, the timescale, April, new budget, no more. And the management of the transition is what's the challenge. In terms of staffing, and this is the time frame, the Department of Education will close in terms of having a home for any staff other than the DG who may continue to mop up. With some functions in terms of finance, but let's not go into that. Also at the end of March. The time frame is that as soon as the ministers have approved the split and the organigram, and as soon as the DBSA has signed off on the organigram, the minister of the DBSA, then I will have staff. Until now, there's nobody. So, what does that mean in terms of your very important question, Chair, in terms of relationships? What we do is we work with people as if they're in the department. I have senior management meetings. But all of the people who attend the senior management meetings are in the Department of Education and are responsible to DG Hindle. So I have weekly senior management meetings, we have strategic planning, and we are having a wonderful time. But nobody reports to me. If somebody chooses not to come, it's a matter of relationships. And it's difficult for them, because now with the appointment of Dr. Subrayan as the DG of Basic Education, a senior manager could be called to a meeting at the same time by DG Hindle, DG Metcalf, or DG Sabine. So it's not easy for senior managers at the moment. Department of Skill of Labour staff have effectively moved across. I think that some of the senior managers are being decreasingly called to Department of Labour. So even though legally they don't report to us, as soon as the legal transfer through the public services happens, then I'll be able to do things like performance management, contract, all of that will then have to be done. So those are the big time frame questions. What does it mean for the questions that have been asked in particular? Minister James has asked if there's a public document, like a white paper or green paper. The policy document that guides all of our work are the legislation. So if you're familiar with the legislation, you know the policies that are governing our work. In the meantime, the minister is, as indicated to the committee, embarking on policy processes. He has made, and I'm sure everybody's very familiar with that, policy statements. Well, not a policy statement. He's made a major indication in the media of how the work of the department is being conceptualised. And I'm sure that if people don't already have it, that can be made available. We are working on policy processes for next year, and that will be led by the minister and will obviously include the portfolio committee and other major stakeholders. We would imagine that that's going to have a two-phase process. Immediate decisions on the basis of already adopted legislation, and in terms of the medium-term policy framework, as well as a medium-term expenditure framework where we can make shifts. Where there are larger ideas that require public consultation and legislative work and the financial implications, we will go through the normal process. So that's the answer to the first question. The second question is the FET section, if I can go back to my introductory comments, we have responsibility for the law. The budget is in the provinces. The administrative functioning in terms of administration of the law is still with the provinces. So when precisely they move, well, it's difficult to say until we've got the constitutional amendment and we can then follow through the functional split. I don't know if I can explain it any more clearly than that.
Your anticipated time.
Well, I think that this committee could be more familiar with me with the length of time it takes to manage constitutional amendments, but I would say if we can get it done in the next financial year, we'll be lucky. And that's what I'm aiming for, is that by the end of the 2010-11 financial year, we should then have the functional split for the colleges. And if I can say in the meantime, we are engaging leadership in the sector very robustly and very frequently, because management of this transition is going to require rely on very good relationships with the sector. So even this week, the minister met with the FET employers organization. We met 2 weeks ago with the principals organization. We've met with the National Board for Further Education and Training, and I'm hoping to get into the diary this year before it evaporates, a meeting of all of those three stakeholders. Because there are huge challenges. We also are involving the colleges in discussions with CETAs and with the National Skills Authority and with the NSF so that we can increasingly see where we can establish the kinds of partnerships and synergy between the skills development component of higher education and training and the colleges in order to really get those synergies going. The second question, I think I might also have answered. In terms of this year, the budget is the budget that was adopted by the joint committees because it's a single budget. We'll have a new budget for next year. That budget that we have for next year, we won't yet know until we get an indicative budget on the 20th of November. And then I understand that budget is going to determine the extent to which we are able to have any latitude for creating new posts. So one of the crucial things that's happening in terms of negotiations with basic education and the RDOE at the moment is, for example, do we get any of the vacant DG posts, or do we, so that those can be advertised. Your three questions, I think, were very important, Member Mashani, is that if I look quickly at the duplication doesn't mean that we're going to be having a doubling up of the costs to government as a whole. There are very few posts, but there are some which are genuine duplications. There has to be a CFO in basic education, there has to be a CFO in higher education, but for the rest of the functions on the whole, there has to be a chief director communication in both. But for the rest of the functions, and it's largely determined by the budget, is that the budget is going to be split and then you can only appoint people according to the budget. So there won't be duplication because there's no fact of duplication. Any of the duplication that's there, we're going to have to get special support from Treasury in order to appoint people. So when we say duplicated, what we've done in the organizational structure is we've taken, for example, communications or finance. We've said, this is a finance team, this is a finance team. It's exactly the same so that people can move from the Department of Education into the same job in basic education and higher education. But then of that organogram for higher education, which is a replication, I should rather have said replication, of DOE, we can only fill the post with the people that come, because that's the only money that exists. So it's like a division. But it's replication because both departments have to fulfill that function. So higher education, basic education doesn't have to fulfill. FET colleges, basic education doesn't have to fulfill. But both departments need system planning and auxiliary services and social cohesion, but we have to
explicit. So I'm sorry, I think that I didn't explain that very clearly. The method of non-agreement, and I think it was very interesting that you picked it up. It is true that to table a progress report means that you you leave issues on the table around which there's no agreement, but they must be resolved. And so in terms of the responsibility and accountability for the budget for the balance of this year, we're waiting for advice from the state attorney. And as far as I understand that there's two courses of action that are possible as a consequence of the advice that we will receive. One will be that the DG of Department of Labor continues to be responsible for voted a fund and vote 15, and that will require that we have a good working relationship to ensure that there's no blockages in expenditure. The other, which for me is the less attractive possibility, is that the CFO of the Department of Education under the accountable person of the DG of General Education, Duncan Hindle, has to be the accounting officer, which I just think will be terrible. It will mean that a person who doesn't have any of the functional responsibility is not working in the policy area would have to be legally accountable for decisions, which will mean that it will, I suppose, that the DG of Higher Education is going to have to take responsibility, but that legally it will be DG Hindle that does. So those are the only two possibilities that we can see, but it does have to be resolved. And in the end, the Minister of the Public Service or the Minister of Finance or the Presidency is going to have to make a ruling. I think that covers your questions. Oh, the consultation. Yeah, the consultation thing is difficult. I've worked very well with staff in the Department of Education and the Department of Labor. There's a range of people, for example, in higher education, who kind of assume tacitly that they work with us, and that's the assumption. It's just that legally they don't belong. I think where the harder issue is in terms of daily functioning is that you don't have a registry, you don't have a communications team, all of those functions are still with education. Thank you, Chairperson. Okay, so your question around deadlines that are not met. Now that, you can see that you've seen that with some of the unresolved stuff that then has a ripple effect, is that now that DG Sobran has been appointed as the DG for Basic Education, I've indicated to DG Hindle that he now has to give this urgent attention, which perhaps hasn't happened up until now. So we have to now really, really fast track. But if you look at the first page of that, for example, recruitment through advertisement of vacancies, the line 23 of that is once we had an understanding of our intact and split functions, we wanted to be able to advertise in October. Well, if we can get the organogram signed off, maybe we can advertise in January, which means then we start the beginning of the year still with a shortage of real leadership, but we'll manage.
Did you? I think I'll start with Honorable Vukusa. Honorable Khate, have you had your hand? Oh, okay. And then the chairperson of
Okay, sorry, I didn't even hear the three quarters of the presentation, so I'm so sorry. but I just want to convey to the DG that the last bit that I heard from the questions of the members, which I think captured the bits that I did not hear, is that I think the committee is awake to your challenges, DG. We can only convey our best wishes because our work depends on how you get your act together. And it just does seem like it is not easy at all. But we have every faith in you that you can, together with us, pull through. It's not going to be easy. It doesn't look like it is going to be easy. Thanks.
Honorable Member. Chairperson? Honorable Mushan, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, a follow-up. Before the Honorable Mushan has said.
Yeah, thank you. So that the Chairperson will... Yeah, you see, I need to maybe talk to. I don't know whether I can advise the DG, but you see, my understanding is that there is this marriage between the departments. we can't talk of divorce, you know. Basic education, higher education, inside, they have to work together. Such that maybe the advice, the unrequested advice that I can give to the department is that you definitely have to work. We the next time we come here, these issues of not agreeing have to be solved. I don't know how. Because the success of higher education is because some things were started well at basic education and vice versa. Such that if people are sitting with some students who cannot read that higher education clearly because somebody didn't do their job down there, and then vice versa. Such that I am appealing on behalf of these committee members, I'm sure they agree with me, that let there be peace. Yeah, thank you.
I'm not so sure, Chairperson, if there can be peace if it's got to do with big functions and big money. Can I say that I think as a committee we need to say that we either have to convene a meeting with the committee chair of labor, one, and that must happen urgent. Second, with the DPSA. And I mean, like, even if needs to be a call needs to be made, because I'm not comfortable with DG what I'm hearing, that you see you cannot have good relations dictating essentially our top priority in this country with health, because good relations can become bad relations. It's depending on how I wake up in the morning. It's dependable on will I take a call or will I take an email? Now there's just no way that we can have that. And hence, even the engagements with the principal associations of FETs and all of those structures, that's forward planning. And that's right. Clearly what we need to get right, and we're going to have to get it right through essential, I think good relations attempted to do that. If I've heard the September engagement in front of the committee, if I heard the October engagement, and now I'm hearing today this. Good relations attempted to put a agreement in place between the Director General of Labor and the Director General of Higher Education and Training. However, good relations has failed to do that. And therefore, one will have to ask the DG to effectively ensure that this issue be taken up, even with whatever executive authority and administrative accountability there is in the state. So the minister is one, DPSA, but even the Director General and the Presidency. Because this must be finalized as a matter of urgency. And I don't wish that we say, like, when we come back in January, I think we need to get a report, not necessarily in a meeting like this, because this is a last meeting, but we are available, and we definitely need to get a report by the end of next week on this matter through the Secretary of Committee. And as I indicated, that if we'll then have to formally meet labor. I think there's just no time for egos. Just no time for egos. Fortunately, the Director General was the MEC. She was an executive authority. She knows that at the level of thinking, at the level of policy, at the level of strategy, one can do wonders. But if it's not grounded in a agreement, if it's not grounded through the PFMA processes, it means nothing in terms of the actual processes. So I think out of this meeting, chair of the meeting, I suspect that's possibly the issue that we need to deal with. It's very clear to me that the transitional arrangement is not proper. It's in fact very, very weak currently. Let's do just that as suggested. I don't even require comment on this because we've heard the DG, and we've heard of more than once. I would want to see, for example, it would be great to have the handover document from labor to higher education. If the DG have it, can you make it available? If not, then we need to request in writing, through the secretary, that we get a copy of the handover document and the transitional arrangement and the meetings that have happened over the last 3 months on this matter. And that must be written to the Director General of Labour, to the Director General of Higher Education and Training, as well as Basic Education. So that would be my suggestion.
Thanks. I think, Gigi, as much as the committee, many of the sentiments that has been passed is to say we understand the challenge. And as much as I understand the challenges, we've got to put things in place and ensure that there's change. We actually start seeing progress towards what we want to achieve and hope. And I think there's been quite suggestions that assist both of us as the committee and yourself. And I really hope that finally we've noted them down and we start actioning from here so that we do not wait for next year, because next year might be late. Because at that time, you are left with about 2 months before you finalize, you start the financial process, new financial year, 2010-2011. So to ensure that we've got everything in place. I think the issue of us having a meeting with the Department of, Portfolio Committee of Labour is quite critical. But again, requesting a handover report, saying that letter you should copy as well the chairperson of Labour so that she's aware of what we anticipate to do. And perhaps if need be, we should be able to have either a joint meeting calling the department to really come and account or put the DGs into that meeting so that we get clarity and just wrap and close the issue so that all of us feel comfortable that there's a clear, bright future ahead. Did you want to say something on the issues?
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I really want to stress that I don't think that there should be a perception that there's a lack of peace. I think that the difficulties are objective. It's very difficult to subdivide functions. And it's very difficult to do during the course of the year. There are difficulties, but I would say that on the whole, the relationships are fairly peaceful. If you look at the matters with education, we're behind, but the quantum of the split has agreed, and the organizational structures are now going to be signed off. The question of deciding on which staff to be moved is just objectively difficult. So that is going to be difficult, but we just have to get through it. But the relationships are not the problem. In terms of labor, I think that we have made a huge amount of agreement. There's been very slow progress because there were particular issues around which either party felt very strongly, which have been resolved, and there's very good working relationships between the task team and our side being led by DDG Patel. And on the Department of Labour, Mr. Sam Maritoba and at the moment the acting DDG are assisting. I think that Member Fransman's suggestion is a very good one. In terms of the National Macro Organisation of the State reports, there are narrative reports which should be submitted in the next 2 weeks. There should be a narrative report from Labour, and there should be a narrative report from Higher Education and Training, and in fact one from Basic Education, Department of Education. So you should in fact request for those reports to be presented to combined committees next year. I think that in most issues by next year we will have agreement. The financial accountability thing has to be agreed. I mean, as we sit, the Auditor General is going to be very curious to know who's accountable for the funds that are being spent. As we sit, we need that agreement, and it isn't yet there. So Treasury, and I'm sure the Auditor General's office and everyone is very keen to get that. The question of the regional staff might take a bit longer. and it might still be on the agenda. It may be that the regional staff will continue on the budget and I don't know about how they'll manage the budget, but they'll continue on the organizational structure of the Department of Labor and their budget for 2010. And just as we go into a year of 2010-11 with FET colleges managing that functional split, we'll have to manage the regional split if it happens. So, Chairperson, just to thank the committee for their support. I'm sorry if the volume of the challenges and that I presented gave you a sense that things are not going peacefully. They certainly are. People are working very hard, and we will get there. Thank you.
There was a question whether you do have a handover report from the Department of Labor, if you can share, so that if you do not have, you can request it there.
Yeah, that's the in-month report. So there's a format where all of the participating departments are reporting through the DPSA to Minister Chabani, and that's what we mean by the national MAC organizational report that should be in the next few weeks. Does that not make sense? Okay.
The handover report.
It's the same report. Okay. Because the handover report will cover all the staffing functions, IT, And that's when the president decided to realign government departments, he established a special project called the National Macro Organization of the State Project, led by Minister Chabani in his office, but primarily driven by DPSA. So all of the handover is managed in terms of that, and there's regular requirements to report. So yesterday we reported, all of the departments reported at one big workshop of all of the affected departments, and that would have been intended to be the final report. But there's more departments where the work isn't yet final. And so there will be, I'm sure, deliberation in Cabinet about how we can now finalise Chairperson, I don't want to take time because I know there's other people waiting. But I do understand the difficulties. To be a DG with financial accountability for a vote, but the function is located somewhere else, it's not an easy matter. I don't think that this is anything to do with people being difficult. It's because the issues are difficult. We had prepared protocols which we thought would safeguard the interests of the DG Labor as well as our functional interests. But in principle, the DG Labor, correctly, and I understand it, is saying, why should I take financial accountability for a function that I'm not managing? So that's why we need legal clarity on that.
Can I give it just because I'm hearing what the DG is saying? Did you win last June and your counterpart at Labour at a meeting?
DG Money and myself have had. Three meetings. I can give the dates. The first meeting was
the last meeting.
The last meeting was a meeting convened by Treasury more than a month ago. That doesn't mean that work isn't proceeding because he's delegated staff and his official commitment with our staff. But the meeting convened by Treasury was to look particularly at the at two blockages. I can provide more information.
I just wanted to know when last the two DGs actually met. That's all that I wanted to know. Because the meeting convened by Treasury, that's normal broader issues. Here is the issue between two departments. There is an operational issue. Because I think one doesn't want to, we shouldn't brush over as if, because it was really in direct response to what the DG in fact said. That no, things are fine, etc. We didn't get that, DG, in terms of this presentation, in terms of the follow questions that came through. That's not the impression that we got out of this. And it's got to do with, and in fact, there's enough legislative framework to deal with this type of, it's not the first time that government is unbundling a department or pulling together departments. It's not the first time. And hence there's protocol and the way I see it, all the elements are there. It is actually signing some of these things that I'm concerned about, meaning that's the problem. And most of these things are objective, but if you know that there is a cooperative st- spirit, then you are able to find there is enough in terms of the current framework to in fact sign something and know how you deal with a functional issue and a financial issue. It's not as if it is you're gonna have to do the extraordinary in terms of a case like this. So I think we've heard the DG, but let's then say that we through the secretary of the committee get that letter drafted, so that we then would be able to get it off to the chairperson of labor, to the director general in the instances that we've talked about, and then also to the respective ministers, and then try and get a turnaround of that information by the end of next week, but obviously convene it in January, the actual meeting.
Thank you, Honorable Franklin. I think the appeal is just to say that where we are sitting as a portfolio committee, it's not necessarily that we would expect you to be involved with your colleague, and we understand where you're standing, but what we'd want to see is just getting the truth and what is actually happening, so that we are able to do an analysis of where we are, an evaluation of the current challenges, so that we can be able to find a solution, all of us, to deal with them. And I hope you understand it in that context, that we are looking at that to ensure that everybody cooperates. Because one is that when you interact with other departments, you find that there's protocols in place, you find there's agreements in place in order to make sure that there's smooth running of everything else. Because legally, as well, as much as we have legislation in place, there are gaps there. Hence, legislation still needs to be amended. So that place, while there's still a need to amend the legislation, should be covered by a protocol, should be covered by an MOU. And lack of that puts a risk to the department, and that's what we are evaluating. We are evaluating and picking up as a portfolio committee. Hence the emphasis, and hence we think or would assume from where we are sitting, with that lack of MOU or protocol signed between the two departments, to us signals a bit of a problem. It might be on which basis I don't think it's immaterial, but for us it's a sign that there's something not going right, for the fact that protocol or MOU is not in place. Honorable Makazi, before we are about to close on this issue, so that we can start our presentation.
Thanks, Chairperson. But I don't want to speak on this, but I just want to make a proposal, chair to chair, that can the ANC component after the meeting, can we meet? If agree.
Must consult the whip first. Okay. No, thank you very much, Titi, for the presentation. We really appreciate it. Then we'll move to the next presentation by SAPQA. The bilaterals, can they stop beside the presentation? You wanted to say something?
Chair, you know what happened yesterday? I think I had a question. I'm just reminded about the ANC component. The minister said there are documents that are given to the ANC members of the study group which are not given to other members. And that's what is happening in this committee also.
Honorable Mpojan, that's not true. What is it? No. Honorable Mpojan, let's not start the debate.
Yesterday.
No. You did not even raise it yesterday because I was in that meeting. Honorable Njim Seha was saying to all members in that committee, and I think it's irrelevant for us even to raise it here, because it should have been raised in the meeting of basic education. And I actually want to say to you that let's take the matter to basic education so that we can clarify with the chair who was chairing that meeting. Here, there's nothing that is happening. A member is requesting her own caucus to meet after the meeting. And that's normal. There's nothing wrong with that. You can do that with IHP as well. You can call the caucus.
I would like to meet with IFP members privately after.
Can we proceed with the presentation?
How is it? Honourable members, I will take the presentation.
Shall we start? Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning, members of the Portfolio Committee. My name is Joe Samuels. Last week, the Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee requested that we make a presentation on the National Learners Record Database to the Portfolio Committee. Myself and the Director for the NLRD, Ms. Yvonne Shapiro, prepared the presentation, and she's going to deliver the presentation to the Portfolio Committee. So without any further ado, I want to hand over to her because, you know, I think there's a lot to say. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for the opportunity to present on the system, and it's good to be back in the town of my birth. Right, just a quick outline of what I'm going to tell you about, the context of the NLRD, what it is, what it does, qualifications and unit standards and how we report on those, learners and their achievements, items being phased in under the NQF Act, the workflow, functionality and system protocols of the system, and the national and international cooperation that we are involved in. Just having a quick look at the context, if we look in South Africa, we know that we have the Human Resource Development Strategy. We have all sorts of actors in that, and I'll speak about them in a moment. And one of those is SACWA and its custodianship of the NQF, and then the NLRD as an assistance to that. If we then unpack that a little bit, the HRDS has some of its objectives to identify and develop priority skills, to focus on engineering and design and artisans, those are critical and scarce skills, and to resolve system challenges. Those are some of what it needs to do. And there are many, many role players, including key ones like the Quality Councils, the CETAs, GIPSA, Statistics South Africa, the universities, and then there's SACWA and the NLRD, giving some assistance there as well, some planned in the future and some already happening. And one of the key things that we are able to do is to record and analyze labor market supply statistics. That is the side that one would do if you're talking about who has what qualifications. There was, in fact, some research done into whether or not the National Learners Records Database should be the system that was used by the HRDS. As you can see from this quote, ultimately it was realized that that was not the core function of the NLRD. The National Learners Records Database under the NQF Act and also previously under the SACWA Act was specifically set up to record information around qualifications and the learners achieving them. If one were to try to expand it to be everything, you'd have to also have a whole lot of analysis of demand side of labor market. And that would then take away from what the core function of the NLRD is. And the research bore that out. GIPSA commissioned research. Several people came to have a very, very detailed look at the NLRD. And this was then the finding, that it must be a major contributor, and a lot of the actual data structure and so on could be used from it, but it is not that system in and of itself. What exactly is it then? It is the integrated information system to facilitate the management of the NQF. It is the first such system in the world. I don't know if people realize that. But when SACWA started, and Joe Samuels and Samuel Isaacs did all the specification of what this NLRD must be, there was a major project to create it. It was sponsored by Canada, and in fact PricewaterhouseCoopers Canada did the work, and they did the most phenomenal job. And still today, 10 years later, 10 years after the launch, it is the leading one in the world. There is no other system in the world that integrates everything that the NLRD does, what does happen in other countries is if they want to do analysis, they have to do a whole lot of merging of other data sets every time before they can do analysis, whereas we already have it in one. The two main functions of the NLRD can be summarized as the kind of macro one, providing information for policymakers, enabling informed decision making, and that includes things like labor market, employment equity, and academic planning. And then the more micro one, the one that's closer to people's hearts individually, is to provide learners and employers with their own proof of qualifications. And in fact, I will speak a little more just now about the very, very big verifications exercise that the DPSA has commissioned. The functions also equate to tracking and analyzing records of learning from school through tertiary education and training to practicing as a professional. And that latter one has come in particularly with the NQF Act as it came in November last year and was implemented from June this year, because the NQF as a whole now has a responsibility also to deal with professional bodies and professional designations, which will then be recorded at an individual level on the NLRD. It is, in a sense, an artificial thing to try and split the NLRD into streams, but in order to understand what it is and does, there are two main streams that we can talk about. The one being qualifications and unit standards and everything that supports them, and the other being learners and their achievements and everything that supports them. The acquisition and capturing and recording and management of those two types of data are handled differently, even though they're all sitting in the same system, and we will talk about them separately. Firstly, looking at qualifications and unit standards. And perhaps I must just digress for a moment. You will have a copy of the presentation, but you will also already have realized that we have added one or two slides since we drafted it. This one was there already, but what I am saying is that this is up to now, that this is how we have acquired the information on qualifications and unit standards and how we've managed it. In going into the future, we do know that there are going to be other standards-generating processes and procedures, for instance, at the Council on Higher Education. But what we do have up to now, the standards-generating bodies and task teams have been very, very busy writing qualifications and unit standards, and they've been through a very specific process of public comment and consultative panels and so on. And all of this information is managed inside the NLRD. If we were to print out what we have on this information, it would be between 150,000 and 300,000 pages. Looking at the major challenges when we have been managing this particular side of the information and the solutions we've adopted, the data volume, as I've said, is very big. There's also, there have been issues of data integrity, particularly at startup, when there were many versions of the records coming in from the standards generating bodies and also from providers that wished their qualifications to be registered on the NQF. And we had to ensure that we had the correct NQF levels, credits, status, and so on. And the sorts of solutions that we implemented were to do data cleaning. And in fact, what came out of that, because we were quite successful in getting some very bright young temps to do some of that work, we then managed to make that a more sustainable solution, and we created South Africa's first information administrator learnership at that time in conjunction with the services CETA. If we look at the ways that people can access information on qualifications and unit standards, on the SACWA website, there's a big searchable database made up of 7 pieces, soon to be 8, and that includes which providers are accredited to offer what which means that from a learner's point of view, they can go and look at a particular qualification and find out who can offer it to them. And they also, for those who need to subscribe to get all the content of the qualifications and unit standards, we have this thing called the XML URL Builder. A lot of jargon, but it actually means that subscribing clients can download enormous amounts of information into their own databases. Just taking you very quickly through a sample of how one would do a search for a qualification or a unit standard, on the SACWA website there is a clickable link to qualifications and unit standards, and that takes you to this page of all the pretty colors. Basically, taking from the top, you've got all the qualifications and unit standards, so you can search for everything no matter what their status, or you can search for just the current registrations, the past registrations, the ones under public comment, and so on and so forth. If you were to choose registered qualifications and unit standards, it then gives you a choice between, do you want qualifications or unit standards? And it also tells you what exactly a qualification is defined as under the NQF, and same with the unit standard. If you then have chosen qualifications, one of the ways to do a search is to type something under the title. This one, just as an example, we said we want to find all the qualifications that have the word freight in their title. And then it tells you there are 8 of those, and the blue clickable links, you can then choose which one you'd like to actually see everything about, and whichever one you've chosen, you get a summary at the top of all the pertinent information, which SGB wrote it, what is its title, its level, its credits, and so on. In fact, these days, it will not only show you NQF level, it'll show you old level and new level. So I apologize for not showing that on this slide, but in this particular instance, with it being level 3, it would also show the new level as level 3. I think most people are aware that under the new Act, we now have 10 levels, and there's a very clear conversion. For instance, a doctorate would have been level 8 and above, and now it's level 10, and so on. So we show both. And then you also get, right at the end of the qualification, all the unit standards that make up that qualification, if it is in fact standards-based. There are some that aren't. And in between that, lots and lots of text about the purpose statement, the outcomes, the assessment criteria, the moderator options, and things like that. This, for you, your takeaway is what we just went through, so that you are able to go and enact that for yourself. And then we have, in that searchable database, we have frequently asked questions. So we answer things like, why can't I find what I'm looking for? And one of the major reasons is that it perhaps doesn't yet exist. There's an email address if you have not been able to find what you're looking for, or your question hasn't been answered in the frequently asked questions, then you email that address and you will, within a day or two, get an answer. Just a little bit more about the information administrator learnership, because all of this information is captured and managed by the people who are on the learnership. The purpose is to ensure data quality and data capturing. And for this stream of the NLRD, the whole point is that the data is in fact received and captured. It's not that it gets retyped, it's copied and pasted in a very structured way. This learnership is in its fourth round at SACWA. In the first round, we started 10 learners and 5 completed. At that point, our selection criteria were not as sharp as they are now, but we certainly learnt a lot about people, in fact, also who were overqualified and wandered off into other directions. The second round, 5 out of 8 completed. The third round, all 8 completed. And in fact, we were able to employ 4 of them as permanent data capturing staff. And we then have another 6 that came in. So under that dispensation, we've got 6 on the learnership and 4 who've become permanent staff. And the qualification that they get is the National Certificate in Data Metrics at UNISA, NQF Level 5. It is also equivalent to the first year of a BSc in IT or IT management at UNISA, and many of them then go on and do the whole qualification. And their job description is that they must capture data, they must ensure the upkeep of our data quality manual, they must study, and they must maintain their learnership logbook. Looking at the numbers recorded on the NLRD at the moment, currently qualifications and unit standards registered on the NQF, whether or not they have passed their end date, but those with status of registered, 11,716. And then unit standards is 15,280. What also happens is if a qualification or unit standard has passed its registration end date, there is still a train-out period. So they are, in a sense, active for quite a while after they've passed the end date. And then we also have, for all of those qualifications, we have the accreditation of the ETQAs to quality assure them, and they are allocated that responsibility in a very structured way. And then we have the registered SGPs. There are still 35 that are current, 152 have completed their work. 27 are still recorded as proposed. I think some of those will not ever materialize and others will still come in to do work. If we look at the next stream, learners and their achievements, there's a different method of getting the information in, and this is just a very summary diagram, but what we're actually saying here is that the providers that are offering qualifications and unit standards, they each have to submit their learner enrollments and achievements to the particular education and training quality assurance body that is responsible for that particular qualification, for instance. And then those 31 ETQAs are responsible for submitting that data to SACWA. I'm very glad that we have to deal with 31 ETQAs because on the NLRD at present we have more than 30,000 providers, and that would be quite something to manage, receiving data from all of them. What we do is the ETQAs each have an information system. In fact, it's one of the criteria to be an ETQA, and they have to be able to extract their data, and there's a very structured way in which they do that. And if everything has gone well with their data extraction and testing, it gets encrypted and submitted to SACWA. And because it's encrypted and then batch loaded from an encrypted data set, there is no opportunity for any person to, for instance, walk up to a keyboard and allocate themselves or anyone else a doctorate. So the security is very high indeed. There is no facility to go up to the front end of the NLRD and make or change qualifications. Everything is received in data sets that are batch loaded and not captured online. If we look at some of the positives that we've experienced over the years in dealing with this information, almost all of the ETQAs do now have excellent information systems. At the time that the NQF started, that was absolutely not the case, but they certainly have them now. And the NLRD has these wonderful load specifications that were initially designed by the developers and that we have maintained ever since, and we've got data loading procedures with very, very good validations of what is coming in. However, there are challenges. Many of the ETQAs don't own the skills to interpret what is expected of them. And that is currently still the case in some places, particularly where we have turnover of staff. We find that when a person's just learned what to do, then they're not there anymore. Then there are also issues of data capturing capacity, and some more than others. Some of the solutions that we have put in place with them and for them over the years. There are some ETQAs that have had the information administrator learnership there in the past, and there's one that's currently a local government CETA has got a learner. And then we have somebody who is based at SACWA, the data learnership coordinator, and he has two major responsibilities. One is to actually deal with the learners who are at whichever ETQA has them, and then secondly, dealing with all the data sets that the ETQAs send in and helping them with feedback. We have also initiated several years ago what we call our minimum standard for data transmission. We tell them exactly what they must do and when. And the minimum standard also says that every ETQA needs to submit everything in their database at least twice a year. And when we say everything in their database, that is because the NLRD has intelligence built into it to say what it has seen before and what is new and what has been seen but must now be updated. So they send everything in and they now know exactly what's expected of them in a one-pager as well as their load specifications. We also have initiated league tables where they go from anything from red, it's actually red, yellow, amber, and green, or red, amber, yellow, green. And they sort of climb the league table, assessing themselves against their own performance, and they are all very keen to retain their green status. We have two parts to the league table. There's a compliance one and a performance one. The compliance one is much easier to manage because you just say, yes, we've submitted, and yes, the data structure was right, and yes, it came in on time. So almost all of them have green status all the time. However, in the performance, it varies between 11 and 17 green ETQA. In order to perform, they have to make sure that they have told us, all the learners, on all of their qualifications, and that their volume of learners is the amount that one might expect from a seat of their size. Then there's also a data testing solution that has been provided to all the ETQAs, and they really like that a lot because it gives them very detailed reports about anything that might be wrong with the data that they're trying to extract. If we look at another quote from the people who did the research into whether or not the NLRD should become the HRDS system or data system, one of the very encouraging findings to us is that they were impressed with how the system had been set up to manage and receive data. So they were commenting on that as a contributor to other national cooperation. If we look at how you can access information in this stream of the NLRD, what we don't have is a searchable database of learners and their achievements. That would be a violation of privacy. But there are various things, and this now looks to the macro side where we have publications and aggregations. And I do have a few copies of the CD of the Trends in Public Higher Education in South Africa. And that is available. Some people get complimentary copies and some people have to buy them. And then we also do quantitative data analyses for each ETQA. We analyze what we've received, and I'll show you an example of that just now. And then we also do customized analyses. We have one going at the moment. The Department of Arts and Culture have asked us to have a look at who is in the pipeline or has achieved on various qualifications to do with heritage, and we're busy doing that for them. Looking at the verification side, that's the one that's the more micro or the personal one, and anybody can ask for a verification of their own achievements. There's the email address. If you email your name, your full name, and your national ID number to that email address and ask for a transcript, you will receive one back showing whatever is on the NLRD for you up to date. And I'll show you an example of that transcript. And then also there's a service where we, for an organization or for an employment agency, with a very, very structured request method that does not violate anybody's rights, we actually allow the verification, we do verification, either for individuals or in large numbers, to say yes or no, we find or we don't find information about those people on the NLRD. This also now includes all government departments. That is under the auspices of the DPSA. The minister has issued a directive that says that all of them have to use the SACWA service for this because they do trust our methods. And here is an example of in what happens. That is a different email address that they need to send to, because for this we're doing for high-level verification, and only very few people have access to this email address. Where a particular government department will be asking, perhaps they're going to appoint a DG and they're going to verify that person's qualifications. They need to then tell us about the person and what the qualifications are and where we must address the response letter to. All of this is as per the directive that came out this year from the minister. Here's an example of the response letter for a fictitious person. What we're saying there is, looking at her qualifications, we are able to find both of the qualifications that she says she has. What also happens is that very often we're asked about things that aren't actually qualifications, although the person might have put them on their CV as if they were. And so we also respond to the other certifications. And here's a fictitious one of an executive development program from UCT Graduate School of Business. Now, that is not a qualification. Qualification has minimum credits of 120, and it also it wouldn't just be a certificate of attendance. You have to have some sort of assessment to do a qualification. But in this fictitious example, we're saying that UCT Graduate School of Business has no record of this person ever attending this course on its campus. And that really does happen when we do the research of whether or not the person was there. Sometimes they actually weren't. The other one, the Chartered Secretary, again, a person would have put that as a qualification. It's not a qualification. It's a professional designation. Yes, they might have gone on a course to learn about being a Chartered Secretary, but if they haven't kept their membership up over the many years, then they are not that designation. This particular one, we're saying yes, but it could have been also that they hadn't kept their membership up. And we also give some recommended wording for press statements to ensure that the differential is made between what is a qualification and what is not one, so that nobody lands up with the egg on their face. This has led to a further data challenge, which we do believe is a major opportunity. Because of the way that we've been asked by the DPSA to do this and to actually follow up on every single last thing, whether or not it lives in the NLRD, we're finding that we're needing to make contact with many perhaps older places or, in fact, in some instances where colleges existed and are now closed and hard copies of information have gone to more centralized places. So we've got a lot of archival information available only in hard copy, particularly where we're going back more than 20 years. That includes some of the former technicons and so on. So we have to get people to open archives to look for information. But this requirement also means that we are in discussion now with some that have, on their own initiative, started converting hard copy information to proper captured data sets, and others where we might have to help them do that. Taking a look at some of the outputs that I mentioned on the CD that we produced on the trends in public higher information, we examine in five major categories the higher education, public higher education trends over the decade 95 to 2004. We are hoping to produce the next one quite soon, although there is sometimes a bit of a lag getting the final audited data from HEMIS, because HEMIS is a funding database. There you can see, for instance, that social sciences and humanities are way above everything else, but the rate of increase isn't very big, having started from a higher baseline, whereas the one that's climbing the most steadily is business and management sciences, from a lower baseline, but climbing. And one can then think through the implications of that in South Africa. The implications, for instance, of engineering not climbing very high and yet being required.
would then perhaps lead to thinking through what strategic imperatives need to happen around that. This is a sample of the sort of analysis we'll do for each ETQA on a regular basis, having received their information. This one's for Mercita, and you can see how the NLRD does in fact record both enrollments and achievements, thinking through those two things are mutually exclusive. Either you are enrolled and you're still busy, or you were enrolled but you've now achieved. And it shows there in the different subfields, the NQF subfields and levels, how many people are doing what sorts of qualifications. The numbers on the NLRD at present, we've got approximately 8.9 million learners. That does include matriculants. And then the providers, more than 30,000, assessors, more than 40,000. And all the learners that we have recorded their enrollments and achievements on qualifications and unit standards. The new things that the NQF Act has brought for SACWA, which the NLRD will be associated with it as well, we are requested to have a credit accumulation and transfer system, and there's a huge amount of consultation that has to happen around that. But once it is implemented, the NLRD will be key to managing that process. And we're quite sure that also, you know, there are times when one institution won't take another one, but if we've managed to properly quantify what people have, we're hoping it'll contribute to portability throughout South Africa. Recognition of prior learning, a very, very big topic at the moment. We already have a lot of records where the achievements are noted as having been done via RPL, particularly from one or two of the CETAs. We can therefore show the RPO trends where those have been noted. That means that we can analyze what the mode is of delivery or achievement. The other sorts of modes are things like contact and distance and so on, and then RPL is one of those categories. We do know that particularly at universities, a lot more work does need to be done on RPL, and we're hoping that they will start noting in their records when the achievements are via RPL. And then another very, very large topic for all of us, the professional bodies and professional designations, a lot of consultation happening around exact definitions. When do we have a statutory professional body or any other kind of professional body? And we then will start recording all of that on the NLRD. It already does exist as a category to be used, but at the moment it's waiting to have the data populated. Yes, I do. So that means you didn't have it all printed out. Yes. Okay, I believe that your presentation wasn't entirely printed out, so you probably think I should have ended already. There isn't much more. We are very near the end. This is just a very brief look at the kinds of things that the NLRD does have to have in order to work properly. For instance, you can't award an achievement to a learner if you don't have a provider that they got it from and a qualification or unit standard that they got. So that's just a sense of how the continuous flow happens inside the NLRD. The sorts of things that it does, very typical of a system like this. And by the way, the name of the NLRD could have also been NQF Management Information System. The name was allocated quite early on in the process because it's kind of stuck. But these are the sorts of things that you can do on it. A sample report. We can extract all sorts of standard reports and non-standard ones. And then very generally the comments on the robustness of the system. The people that do the DBA for us at the moment say that they have never seen anything as well put together as this one.
the data model is excellent, and in fact one or two very small little tweaks that needed to be made have now been done in version 2. We did once have a devastating crash, and thanks to some negligence that we won't get into, there weren't proper backups, but now they are. But we managed to rebuild it because the basic structure was very, very sound. And then the DBA does ensure optimal functioning. It's a very well-functioning data set. This is one aspect of the security. We manage the user profiles extremely carefully so that people have only access to what they need to have access to, what they're authorized to have access to. Our data exchange protocol, one of the key things there is that we don't share platforms with other places. That would be asking for corruption or viruses or whatever. What we do is when we give or receive data, we extract whole data sets, or we receive whole data sets and use validations to put them in. And as I said, for the batch loading of the Lunar data, that's all encrypted. Our system backups, in fact, that the crash was a major wake-up call, and we then certainly dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. And we make huge backups, including also incremental ones in between. And we also only use the testing database for anything to do with development, and we in fact test load everything in there before we would ever dream of loading it into the live system. A quick look at national cooperation. We have cooperated with GIPSA in the study around the human resource development system, and then also currently they have funded some assistance with filling some gaps in the NLRD, which has been very useful. Statistics South Africa, we are in cooperation with them to be declared national statistics, official statistics. Department of Labour, the Employment Services South Africa, we do supply them with some data for their system, although they're not using that as regularly as they should. And then HRDS has to do with the GIPSA research. And we will also give a lot more assistance once the other system is off the ground. And then I sit on the Department of Education's Education Information Standards Committee, giving advice on data structures and so on. We have assisted SACE when they needed to develop their system for continuous professional development. We gave a lot of advice as to what they needed. And Hari Gude, we have all of their data in the NLRD and have produced some analysis for them. And then the next acronym probably isn't known to you, HEQCIS, Higher Education Quality Committee Information System, where we have a cooperation project with them to assist the Council on Higher Education to record all the information on the learners at 105 private higher providers. That's the total number that are registered or accredited by the CHE. And they didn't have any method at all for gathering that data. And we, together with them, devised a whole method, and we have a couple of people working on that full-time, paid by them. And they rent service space at SACWA, but are treated like any other ETQA data set and have to test their data before it can be loaded onto the NLRD. And that project is going very well, and the private hire providers have become very happy users also of EduDex testing. We would very much like to do the same for further education. Of course, that would require funding if we were to do that. We have also been asked to give a lot of assistance to other countries, the ones that are developing their own systems and have requested extensive assistance. Mauritius, I wrote their spec for their system quite recently. United Arab Emirates invited me to come and
show them what we do and to put in a proposal to develop a system for them, they're waiting to be declared an authority rather than just a project before they're allowed to go ahead with that. And Seychelles has spent time at SACWA learning about various of our systems, including the NLRD. Other systems, European Qualifications Framework, invited us to present at a conference in September where we were speaking about student data portability. Namibia has come for workshops, Botswana visited recently, and then we also give lots of presentations to many different countries. So in summary, where are we now? We have large volumes of qualifications and unit standards. We have large volumes of learners and their achievements. We also know which gaps we need to fill, for instance, where we need to get the archived data and make it electronic together with the owners of the data. We're assisting a variety of others. We are also now intensifying or starting CAT, RPL, and all the information around professional bodies. We would like to assist FET private providers with further education. And where this would take us would be that we'd have complete tracking and analyzing records of learning from school through tertiary education and training to practicing as a professional. So in conclusion, the NLRD has come into its own and is constantly developing and responding to trends, but we are assisting with tracking the paths of individual learners and informing policy making and decision making in education and training and in labour market analysis. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Committee members, we're just going to meet hands for discussion and comments. Honourable Fukusa, Honourable Mushon.
Thank you. Should I call you Yvonne?
Yeah.
That's not too familiar. Thanks. Your last, probably your second last slide answered my question in terms of whether this capability or system, we own it as South Africa, is patented as such and secured as such, and whether, I'm just worried about your terminology in terms of assistance. Are you selling this capability to Mauritius, United Arab Emirates? What is assistance, in other words? I'd like to understand that, because I think if we own the capability, then we sell the capability. So that's it. I'm worried about assistance. I'm just worried about those, but you'll jot that down and probably too. Well, of course, if your more than 20-year qualifications are in hard copies, I'm sure mine are in archives. I just wanted to say that. Surely they are not in the system. Well, the other thing was, I think the nation herself, the nation, yeah, the sheep, we don't quite understand the difference between a qualification, a professional certificate, and other certificates. And I think that many people will commit crimes of that not...
Honourable Mboshan,
no, that's
one out of order.
Mm. I'm saying that there's need to just educate the nation in terms of what is there, because even myself, I'm not too sure. To the extent that I don't know where you accommodate, for instance, corporate. I don't know now whether to say qualifications or certificates, but I know that corporates have got a lot that are not quite in the system, but they offer all sorts of training. So whether that comes into the CV to be acknowledged or not, I don't know. Interesting that you had a presentation, just a slide on MISETA, because I just read the HSRC report, which is it's one of the most, maybe you were also clever to give us the most functioning CETA, because the other ones are not. And the last one is that, Yvonne, I don't know, talking about specific messages for specific audiences,
I had to quite apply my mind to your presentation. So probably, how more user-friendly could you make it for other consumers of this information? I found that it's very good, quite elaborate, but probably a little more user-friendly for other audiences. You know, I don't know. So, thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson of the session. I've got very short questions. There are four. The first one is on the trend in public education institutions, the trend that business and management has grown. It shot up, actually. And one is wondering if that's where business is these days. Because isn't it whatever we do, we want to make sure that people end up working somewhere, employment. It has to fit to employment if a country is functional. Now, I realize that the others have gone down. And I see that you talk of the achievement. This is the second question which is married to this one. That you capture the achievements of learners, I guess, the students, however, those achievements. But are these achievements married to their being employed? Because you can get an A or a distinction, or we call you professor so and so and you are not working, and that becomes a very serious challenge. Now, I'm checking if these achievements end up in employment. And we say, this one achieved 1-3 and ended up happily employed somewhere, it doesn't matter where in the world. And the third one is on assistance that you are giving outside. Mine is a little bit different. Otherwise, I would say it's covered to where the owner. Oh, she'll come back for your answers, I'm sure. Yeah. But then, but mine is like, I appreciate that you are assisting Namibia and Botswana, particularly. I'm very happy, these are neighbors. But I'm taking. In the European ones, are you assisting or you were invited to give a report? And what is going to happen after I've learned? What's going to be done about your report? We need to check these relationships. And then finally, the data that you are keeping is uploadable. Maybe I'm uploadable. I'm trying to use that very serious English, you know. That you are doing something good, you know, we need to capture, we need to know exactly where we are as a country. And it's wonderful what SACWA is doing, except that whatever you do, please let it be connected to employment, for sure, so that you can stop others from training and say, you cannot continue to train because these people are not going to work anyway. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Makube.
Thanks, Chairperson. I don't think perhaps I need to apologize for arriving a bit late earlier on. It's like it's known everybody was stuck somewhere. Okay. The issue I want to check is in terms of data integrity. It's like you were saying in your slides that you do have some solutions, but by now have we got that solution, or is still a problem that is ongoing? To what extent are we still having problems in that regard? But then the data that we've got, is it only from accredited institutions? Or what is it that is happening there? Is it only domestic or also foreign? What is the situation? And in terms of access to this whole information, what are we doing in terms of reaching out broadly? I just think that there may still be quite a number of learners who may not necessarily be able to access that and so on. Are we able to do something? The last point is whether the system can can still be upgraded in terms of some features that are currently not there, or there is provision. It's only that as and when you need that or those features, you can still be able to ensure that we install those, or what is it that happens with the system text.
Thank you so much, Honorable Members. I see Honorable Vukuzo is back. Honorable Mushan is back.
Okay,
I think just appreciating the presentation, and more than anything for me, Ms. Shapiro, is around the issue of how well known is the system to the country and to the people that are needing to know about it. Employers out there, learners themselves, and in terms of just making sure that it's updated, it's linked to that of being known, that am I as a learner able to phone in some way and say, my qualifications are not reflected on your database, I've done this, so the trainings or whatever that it is that I've done, so that it gets updated, so that we have, because the issue is to overall move to a system that we can all rely on. And if this is a system that can be able to have the capacity to give us qualifications or certificates of individuals, do we have that functionality and the capacity of the people that are managing it? To what extent they're able to expand, do you have a small group that's able to get a sizable number of inquiries and all those things? And what are the future plans of making sure that the system grows bigger to it is with the personnel, obviously. I noticed that at some point you raised the issue of receiving funds. Is there anything that you're doing towards getting that fund to expand part of the mandate and the work that you want to do? Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for the comments and questions. I'm just going to work through them as they came. Firstly, the question of us owning it as a South African system, yes, most certainly. SACWA is owned as a South African system, the NQF is, and so is the NLRD. And yes, when this kind of assistance is given, it's not actually given for free, it is paid for. We do sell the services, and if we were to develop a database for somewhere else, we would do it at a fee. For instance, if Mauritius were to go to tender on it, we would maybe tender, but we might need to simply project manage because we wrote the specs, but they would need to pay us for that. In terms of the archived information, actually we do have a huge amount of very old information that's in the NLRD, so I hope I didn't quite give the wrong impression. The ones that we don't have are things like where it only exists in hard copy. However, in South Africa, a huge amount does exist electronically. One of the main things was that we took over all the data from the Register of Graduates of the Human Sciences Research Council. That had been in existence from 1965, and it had some university data going back to 1914. And we took that all over. I used to be at the HSRC managing that, and I then managed the getting the data from the one to the other. So that was 600,000 learners that were transferred in one fell swoop in 2001. So, and in fact, from 1986 onwards, what the HSRC had held were complete data sets of every year of every university in South Africa. So from 86 up to last year, we actually have a full data set. We do know there are one or two known gaps where we have to go and relook. For instance, we know that the University of Natal in the mid-90s did a migration from one system to another, and in extracting data, they dropped some records. So we also know, therefore, that if somebody comes to verify mid-90s records from the University of Natal and we don't find them, it doesn't mean they've committed a fraud. It means we actually have to get in touch with the University of Natal and fill that gap offline
until we get a project together with them that we can go back into their archives and get the data back. But we have a huge amount of very, very old data,
so your data may well be there.
Okay. Yeah, I agree that there are a lot of people who don't yet understand the difference between a qualification, a short course, a professional certificate, and so on. And SACWA would like to contribute more towards that understanding. At some point, we will probably convene some workshops around that. But what we are doing is, as we give this feedback now in these letters, we are being as clear as we can, which we do hope will contribute enormously to capacity building in the human resources functions in the, I think it's about 150 national and provincial government departments. And concerning corporate qualifications, if somebody does training as part of, for instance, Absa Bank, a worker at Absa Bank or one of the other banks, and that then is channeled through to Bank CETA, it will come into the NLRD. But that would be if it was linked to some unit standards. However, we are very aware that a lot of the banks are doing training that specifically is not linked to anything LQF related. And at present, they haven't been uploading that into the NLRD, although we do have a facility for people to load information that is not NQF related, and we label it as such, and we still have it against those learners. But some seem to be reluctant for some reason to do that, and we have to do a bit more advocacy on that. And MERCETA, yes, I did choose it because it has enough data to analyze nicely and show a very, very clear graph. Some of the others, the graphs are not as easy to read. But what we are doing in every instance is giving each ETQA back graphs like that, and also a list of qualifications where we have on record that SACWA has accredited them to quality assure those qualifications, and they're not showing any movement on them. And then we ask them to please tell us why not, and there are sometimes very, very reasonable answers to that. For instance, if you have a suite of qualifications that go level 2, level 3, level 4, you can't do the level 4 one until you finish the other two. So then it takes years to get through the others before you can show any uptake on the later ones. Messages for audiences and being user-friendly, yes, I probably did get a bit technical. What I was trying to do here, I felt that I would want to put something for everyone. My understanding was that there were people with different hats in this audience. But yes, I do very much take your point there. Thank you. Then looking at the trends and showing how we've got, for instance, business and management climbing like that, yes, the whole thing with the NLRD, though, is that it is not a labor database. And that was the research that was done and the conclusion that was come to actually keep it as a database that, as per the NQF Act, we must talk about records of learning. If we were to do the other, it would then become more of a labor market analysis, and that we would rather then contribute into another database that was doing that. There also then are issues of how one does trace assistance and how one tracks that people are employed. Because even if they are maintaining a professional designation, that doesn't necessarily mean they're employed. When we had the register of graduates at the HSRC, with it being a much smaller database, there were some tracer studies done. It was very interesting, and in fact, people can still find in the HSRC library the previous, for instance, remuneration of graduates surveys that were done. But those needed to be discontinued when the register of graduates closed. However, there certainly could be the potential for doing tracer studies, but they are extremely expensive and they need very specific expertise and funding. But there would be nothing to stop South Africa as a nation doing that. I think I've answered about the international assistance. And then
Yes, again, all the connections to employment I have answered there. The data integrity and have our solutions solved our problems? Yes, indeed they have. One of the key things there was the whole solution of this thing called EduDesk. It was actually developed based on what we initially had put in place for ETQAs to examine their data, to pull in the extracted data into something that will talk to them about what's happening there. And in fact, SACWA in the end decided to buy the license from the developers to distribute EduDex free to everybody who's a data supplier to the NLRD. So we do that, and that thing then tells them all the reporting on what they still need to do to get their data right, and in fact it will not encrypt data and submit it into the holding bay for the NLRD if there's anything wrong with it whatsoever. So that has been one of our key solutions. But in general, yes, we have solved the problems of data integrity, and the NLRD itself anyway has the most fantastic set of validations that were built into it when it was developed. What EduDex is doing is preventing the NLRD from stopping when it has started to load something and is finding that it's not okay. We don't even start to load until we know that it's going to be okay. Getting information from accredited institutions, yes, mostly that is the case, because we're getting them from the ETQAs that have accredited the different providers to offer qualifications and unit standards and are sending information in. However, a lot of the ETQAs also have very old data from the old training boards, and wherever that is electronic, they've also sent that in. And the old training boards were not accredited as such because the NQF didn't exist at the time, but we get anything that's electronic. We also, the Hari Gude is not an accredited institution as such, but we have all their volume of data. We also get data from the Independent Examinations Board and one or two other places like that. So wherever an electronic data set linking learners to their qualifications is available, it can be loaded into the NLRD. Concerning whether it's only domestic or also foreign, we did inherit some information on foreign achievements from the old Register of Graduates, which did have some of them. However, since it came into SACWA, we're not loading any more from providers themselves. However, you're probably aware that SACWA has the Directorate for Foreign Qualification Evaluation and Advisory Services, and they, of course, are databasing what they get in to evaluate. And ultimately, we will load that data into the NLRD. There are one or two little hoops we have to jump through before we can do that, but we will be doing that. And also, they will be doing the verifications, not only evaluation for equivalency, but also verification of the actual achievements from next year because of the directorate from the DPSA. Our outreach, we are happy that, in fact, the NQF as a whole, with all of our partners together, has an advocacy project that has started recently. And it has a few tentacles to it. One of them is taking queries via a help desk, and wherever those need to be channeled to us, they are. But the other part of that is, in fact, going out there with a campaign to tell people about the NQF and what it offers, and the NLRD is included in that. Can the system still be upgraded? Yes, it can. The most wonderful thing about the type of database that this is, it's a relational database. You could also think of it as a modular database. That actually means that whenever something new is needed, one can kind of slot it in. And for instance, when we started the NLRD, there was no notion that we would ever have to deal with professional designations. And then a few years ago, we realized that we would exactly have to deal with those. Another example is learnerships, people going through learnerships and coming out the other end of them. There was no notion originally that we were going to have that on the NLRD. both of those things have now been had modules built into the NLRD, which are slowly being populated as and when the supply data of that is ready. Learners themselves requesting updates, what they need to do if we do find a problem, and we do tell them that once they've requested a transcript of what they have on the NLRD, if something isn't there that they would have expected, we ask them to tell us so that we can follow up, because usually that is an indicator of a gap, like the Natal University mid-90s gap. And what we do then is we systemically follow that up. In the future, we would also possibly have a function on the SAPA website where learners would be able to update their own address and things like that, but never their own qualifications. Qualifications are taken from source and only from source. And that is, in fact, why the DPSA has requested SACWA to be the one to do the verifications, because we never look at a piece of paper and say, this looks okay, the person has this thing. Our future plans are to be as, it's a mixture of being proactive and reflecting the needs. So when there is a need like RPL and like credit accumulation and transfer, yes, we're right there in there offering our services, and then at the same time actively looking at where the system needs help, and that's how we feel that we can help with private FET, and there will definitely be other things in the same vein. Thank you.
Sorry, Chair, can I just add two things to what Yvonne has said? You know, SACWA is part of the SADC region, and in the SADC region there's a committee that deals with certification and accreditation. And given the fact that we have started our national qualifications framework and our systems long before other countries, you know, there is a commitment on our part to assist those countries that would like to start the NQF, also to help them with their information system. So you would see on the list that Yvonne had raised, there was Botswana, Namibia, Seychelles, Mauritius, and so on. So all of that is part of the commitment to working together and to assisting people within the SADC region. So we are not selling the information, but it's really about the expertise that we have in terms of setting up these particular things. And of course, you know, if Yvonne is out of the office, we actually need to recoup the fact that she has spent time, you know, with those people. So, you know, quite clearly that it's our information, it's our NQF, and we are really just assisting where we are requested to. The second one I want to just add a little bit, we understand that the questions about qualifications, professional designations, and the issue of short courses is a big issue, as it were. So part of what we are doing with the DPSA is to provide them with information. What we have done now is we had a national workshop with all the national departments, and we have done 8 of the provinces. The only province that we still need to do in terms of a workshop is Gauteng that we will have. So we do realize, in fact, that we need to have a number of other workshops with the broader public so that people can understand it, but we are working, you know, around that in a systematic way. Then, Chair, the question about whether we only have data from accredited providers, the point here is, we don't have information of fly-by-night. So in other words, if a person goes to a fly-by-night institution, we will not have that information because it's a fly-by-night. And Yvonne was very clear in saying that there's a particular kind of process in which the information comes from accredited providers, comes to the ETQA that is set up by law and so on, and the information gets audited and then it comes to us, so that we are very sure about the accuracy of what we get. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm going to note 2 hands and then we close on the issue. Honorable Gina. Okay, I'm sure.
Ms. Jefferson, I've got the only one question to say, who has got access to? It's on. Okay. I'm checking on the access. Who has got an access to the information? Can I come and request the information for is it an institution just to do that, if I can
be clarified on that one.
Thank you. Mine is a follow-up question, actually, and because I'm concluding that the countries where you offer assistance, especially in the SADC, they are well to do. They don't give us challenges. I don't want to say problems. Then there are countries that you do not go, and they are giving us a lot of challenges, like Mozambique and Zimbabwe. I'm checking, is it possible for you to go and assist? Because maybe that's the reason why they think they can only survive in South Africa. But if you can go and assist them like they're assisting these others, perhaps it can promote peace, you know, in this
You're consistent in speaking of peace. I don't know what happened. Something happened that peace needed. I think any I suspect it has something to do with Honorable Poitin.
And lastly, the capacity of the system.
Are you hijacking yourself into the platform, Honorable Poitin?
No, I was just wondering, my understanding, that the system doesn't capture those who have fallen by the wayside to you.
Okay. Honorable members, let's take the questions. I'm now watching the time because we still have two more items to go through. So, you are suppressed for now. Okay, thanks. Yes, who's got access to the information? It does depend which aspect of the information we're talking about. Access to the qualifications and unit standards on the SACWA searchable database on the website, free 24/7. Access to information on learner achievements in an aggregated way that can be given out to anybody depending on who's asking and what they're asking. We can either very quickly give something for free or like with the Department of Arts and Culture where they've commissioned a project to analyze what's happening in the heritage side of things. We'll be giving them a report that they will pay for on gender and population group and so on of the people in that sphere. Then we also sell the report, The Trends in Public Higher Education. It takes quite a lot to produce a report like that. But access to your own record is completely free. You email your name and your ID number to verifications@sacra.org.za, and free, you get a transcript back. And I must apologize, I forgot that I hadn't put a copy of that transcript into this presentation, so I haven't shown you an example today. But if you email us, you'll get that for free. But you can't come along with somebody else's ID number and say to us, just tell us everything you know about so-and-so, because we won't. What you can do, though, is if you're wanting to employ somebody and you want to check what they put on their CV, you can pay us, and it's a very small amount, actually, to look on the NRD and see if we find that. How much? It's 50 rand a person. Under the DPSA project, it's a slightly different financial dispensation, but if you as an employer come along, it's 50 rand a person, no matter how many qualifications they have. And yes, before the historical records, there's the size, the capacity. The NLRD is not even half full with what it already has. I think the capacity that we would be able to put for learners and their achievements would be 40 million. And we currently have 8.9. Okay. The historical, people who've fallen by the wayside, if you mean people who enrolled and never finished, I don't know if that's what you mean, that we do have. But we don't capture what we would refer to as failure. If a person enrolled somewhere and they actually failed the course and they didn't re-enroll, it would actually just show forever as enrolled. Unless the institution came and said, please change it to withdrawn.
or one of the other things we have. But we actually don't have a status of failed. Just so that you know. We do actually, though, have a status called withheld, which is where they have passed, but they didn't pay, so the institution is withholding the graduation. We do have that one. Joe is going to answer the other one.
Chair, there's also a second aspect to falling by the wayside. What we also have is a number of, over the years, you know, institutions may have been accredited, but, you know, then they fall by the wayside. So we do have, I mean, if they have been accredited, we do have records of those institutions. And then also the last number of years, there's been a number of mergers and name changes and so on. We still have those records. So if, for example, you went to the you know, to the Pretoria Technicon, for example, you know, we would have those records available, you know, and it's now under the kind of broadening of the Tshwane University of Technology. So we do have those kind of records. Chair, the issue about, you know, the SADC region, in fact, you know, I'm the vice chairperson of this committee. The chairperson of the committee is from Zimbabwe, you know, so we do assist, you know, and in fact, this, you know, people from Zimbabwe came to visit us to see how the system is working and so on. But what we're very clear about is that we don't want to go and say to people, you should do this and the other things. They don't ask us. You know, and I think it's a very delicate thing, particularly in the SADC region, that we are not seen as the United States, you know, of the world and so on. In terms of Mozambique, we have assisted Mozambique. In fact, about 2 days ago, there was a big Mozambican delegation that came to Sokoto to see how things are going. So, you know, although it wasn't mentioned there, you know, we do assist, you know, them as well.
Thank you very much for the presentation and the response, Mr. Solomon and Simon Samuels, also Samuels and Shapiro. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. I think the committee will continue to interact with you on the information and continue. I'm going to request that it's only the committee members remaining, so that we can deal with the report of the committee. So we ask that everyone else excuse us, so that it's committee members.
Thank you.